do you see different developments in Europe or in the Netherlands than in the U.S. and Canada?
In Europe, there's more of a commitment to public education. In the United States especially, education is, there's more private education, there's more commercial education. Corporate education is bigger in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Less so in Canada. Canada is a bit more similar to Europe in that regard because we have a public education system.
Not only in that regard.
Yeah. Also, there's a strong base of support for open source software and open access in Europe. Much stronger than in the United States or even in Canada. Again, there's more in Canada than in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of work comes out of Europe in open software. But then the problem, of course, is it has to make that trip across the Atlantic Ocean. And that doesn't always happen. So we don't, there's a lot that happens in Europe that we don't see in North America just because, you know, the distance and the communication, and you have all kinds of funky languages.
But you see lots of it. You hear of it.
Sure, yeah, but I look for it, right? You know, I mean, like, it's part of my job to try to understand what's out there and to learn about what's out there so that I can come up with something like a coherent theory and a coherent approach.
Mm-hmm.
So I take time, well, pretty well every day, to look for stuff, not just in Europe, but around the world. And so I subscribe to a number of newsletters. There's the European SchoolNet is one that springs to my mind. A bunch, you know, some of the European Union Sixth Framework stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get a lot of that information get sent to me, and then of course I would read blogs and things like that in English because my Dutch not so good.
No, not surprising.
Right.
Why is open source so important for education?
Well, it's a question of access, right? The objective is to make learning available to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs a certain amount of money to make learning available to any given person. Right now, when we think about how much it costs to send somebody to school, to buy them books, to send them to college or university, they pay their tuition, they may pay residence, it costs a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to make education available to everyone, then the costs become more than society can afford.
Mm-hmm.
This is especially the case, and Sir John Daniel likes to talk about this, and I think he's right. When we talk about worldwide education, you know, there's 6 billion people on the planet, and maybe a billion of those people now have access to higher education, universities, things like that. So imagine spending six times as much money on education as we do now. It becomes very difficult. It's, you know, look at China. China opens 100 universities in a year, and it's still not enough. The expense is staggering. So, having open source software and having open educational content brings down the barrier to access because it means that people can get the core of an education for free. And then either through social networks or communities of practice or in some cases hiring a tutor if necessary or something like that, they can supplement what they need. The more higher end education becomes applied only where it's needed rather than across the board.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have open software, open standards, open access to make this work. You have to have the network of resources to make this work. Otherwise, you will always be running into situations where you need a resource, but it's not available. And, you know, when that happens once or twice even, that's enough to discourage a student from continuing. They wanted to learn, but they couldn't learn. They say, well, forget this. So you have to have that base of resources there that allows them to go forward.
What you're saying now is very similar to your mission statement. I think that's on your website.
It is on my website, yeah.
Are you optimistic that this is a realistic...
Oh yeah, it's totally realistic, yeah.
Do you have an idea of, is this going to take 10, 50?
Well, I'm hoping it happens in my lifetime. So that could be like tomorrow. I'd like to see it happen in my lifetime. It might not, but I think that's a reasonable target. But, you know, I mean, a lot of factors could come into play. It depends a lot on the funding for these initiatives. I think, you know, governments and public funding has a large role to play. It depends a lot on the political environment, whether governments are favoring learning as a form of commercial development as opposed to learning as a form of social development. If they see learning as a commercial enterprise, then they will encourage the pricing of learning resources and learning activities, and that will slow down access. It will make it harder, and it means our base of content won't be there. Well, not for a while, right? But the thing is, too, there's enough people out there at any given time producing free resources that over a certain amount of time, these resources will be there. They will be there one way or another. Just like, you know, 10 years ago, there weren't that many websites. Now today there's a website on every subject you can imagine. And it'll take a longer time, but the same thing will happen with learning resources, where over time there will be a learning resource available on any subject you can imagine. And then it's a matter of bringing them in, organizing them. And that's where the system I talked about today comes into play.
I was telling you before, the system, on an abstract level I can imagine,
right.
The technology is over my head. Is the technology that's necessary to make this system work, is it available today?
Big parts of it are. And the knowledge and the understanding is available today. A lot of the tools are not there yet. But, you know, every day I'm seeing a tool that's a little bit closer. Does a little bit more. These tools will all be in place, you got to figure, very shortly. But it's hard to say. Again, it depends. Depends on people.
When you speak of open content, do you have in mind all these individuals that are producing learning resources? Let me rephrase the question. I have a hard time imagining institutions producing open source content, since it costs them a lot to create it. And
right, but that's because the picture you have right now is learning resources are produced by institutions or publishers, right? But with open content, learning resources can be produced by anybody. And where we will see most of our learning resources produced in the future is by students. Because it's part of their own learning, right? As part of their learning, they create a resource. And once they've created a resource, it goes into the system and somebody else brings it in. And that becomes part of their learning, and they take that and they create another resource.
And isn't there a problem of sort of verification of our...
Yes.
Like
but
with Wiki, more or less?
Well, I mean, but the thing is, there's two ways of handling quality. One way is to have an editor or a review board or something like that screen all of the things and pick the best ones. But that's a bottleneck. It's very slow. Even where the institutions the only ones producing the resources. There's still too many resources coming in for a body like that to do. There's an organization in the United States called Merlot, M-E-R-L-O-T, all capital letters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do. They do a review process. But there's funnel.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other way of handling evaluation is everything goes into the system. And then all the people, they see these things as they come in and they start using them. And some they like and some they don't like. And the ones they like, they keep using. The ones they don't like, they don't use again.
Mm-hmm. Like the AM story.
Right.
But
exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Same mechanism. Each person makes their own decision. Is this mm-hmm. working for me? Is it not working for me? And then, as long as you capture that decision,
mm-hmm.
you record that decision, and that's what I call second-party metadata.
Mm-hmm.
You record that decision, and then out of all of those resources that have come into the system, a few begin to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
yeah.
And the ones that stand out will be the quality ones. People, a large group of people, each making their own decision autonomously, will pick the best resources.
Mm-hmm.
And then those are the ones that are more likely to show up in a search, if you do a search.
Yeah. And also social networks will help.
And the social networks help refine the search. Classification and evaluation systems also help refine the search. So now it becomes a question, okay, how do we refine the search?
Mm-hmm.
So that not only are we just getting best resources, but we're getting the best resource for particular people or for particular circumstances.
Mm-hmm. On your website, I noticed a few people, very different backgrounds, were saying that the systems they used were so, that the institutions gave to them were so complex that they didn't use them at all, and instead they
right.
went back to very simple tools and used them for online education.
Right.
But why is it so hard to keep things simple?
because people, when they design technology, they try to solve all the possible problems, right? Are you familiar with the something called the 80-20 rule?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. When they design software, they're designing 80% of their features for 20% of the population, and the software bloats. Now what they need to do is stick to just design for 80% of the people. And the other 20%, they can build their own specialized applications.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But they try to build all the features into a single piece of software. So because that 20%, they're really loud. And they complain. Your image editing software doesn't do raindrops. And so they add a raindrop feature. Like nobody else wanted, but now it becomes part of it. So they need to focus on serving the needs of 80% of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my view.
You're a strong advocate for small and simple things.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, I'm a small and simple man advocating small and simple things.
Also, you like bottom-up initiatives.
Yes.
Isn't that true?
Well, because the decisions are better.
Right. Why is that?
The decisions are better because a large group of people collectively can take in many times more variables and factors than any individual making a decision. When you have, say, the president of a company trying to make a decision, no matter how smart that person is, they can only take into account so many things. And usually what they take into account is from their own personal perspective, their own experiences, friends that they know. It's a very, you know, like anybody, it's a narrow perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So a single person acting as a manager is, in virtually all cases, not capable of making a better decision than a group of people, and will frequently make a much worse decision.
Yep.
And so I try to enable mechanisms that, or create mechanisms that enable large groups of people to make decisions, each one autonomously for themselves, where the decision flows up from that group of people.